Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Hello, and welcome to If You Love This Planet. Today I'm interviewing John Church, who's an oceanographer with the Centre for Australian Weather and Climate Research and the Antarctic Climate and Ecosystems Cooperative Research Centre, with expertise in the role of the ocean in climate, particularly anthropogenic climate change. He was co-convening lead author for the chapter on sea level in the IPCC Third Assessment Report, and he chaired the Joint Scientific Committee of the World Climate Research Program from 2006 to 2008. John Church was awarded the 2006 Roger Revel Medal by Intergovernmental Oceanographic Commission and presented the 2008 AMOS R.H. Clark Lecture. Just to briefly explain, the IPCC is the International Panel on Climate Change, the World Panel on Climate Change. The CSIRO stands for, John, you'll have to tell me.
The Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organisation.
Yes, it's the leading scientific body in Australia. So welcome to our program, John.
Thank you, Helen.
John is actually the world's leading expert in ocean level rises. And I've just read a report, John, right now, which has just been published, to say that the Arctic has less ice now this summer than ever before. Have you seen, you must be aware of that report, are you?
I haven't actually seen that report. I have seen the area covered by sea ice, and for this time of year, I think it's the lowest in the records. It's still decreasing as it decreases until about September.
And then it increases because the winter comes on. Just before we start, why don't you explain what the albedo effect is? Because that's very relevant to your work and to sea level rises. What is the albedo effect?
So the albedo of the Earth is a measure of how much of the solar radiation that is actually reflected by the Earth. So the Earth is warmed by solar radiation. Some of that is reflected by clouds and at the surface, roughly 30%, and the remainder is absorbed principally at the land surface and the ocean surface, some in the atmosphere as well, but principally at the surface. Then the Earth warms and re-radiates the energy.
Okay, but specifically applying that to the Arctic ice and I guess the Antarctic ice, what happens? I mean, obviously it's very white and it reflects the heat of the sun back into the atmosphere, but what happens when the ice melts and there's no whiteness, there's only black of the sea?
You're right, the ice, both on land and over the ocean, and also snow cover, of course, is one of the mechanisms that by which the solar radiation is reflected. If you reduce the sea ice cover or the snow cover, or even change the reflectivity of the snow or sea ice, then you can actually reduce the amount of solar radiation reflected back to space. And that's an additional amount of energy the Earth absorbs, and therefore it warms further. So this is one of the positive feedbacks in climate change?
Well, when you say positive feedbacks, it means that it increases the level of global warming because black water and the colour black absorb heat, while the white ice reflects the heat back into the atmosphere, right?
That's right. The oceans do reflect some of the solar energy, but the majority is absorbed. Mm. So whereas the sea ice, particularly when it has snow cover on it, reflects most of the solar energy.
I suppose that's true too for the mountains and the glaciers. And I was fascinated to read the other day that in Argentina, people are so worried about the glacial melt and global warming, they're actually whitewashing the mountains. They're painting the black rock of the mountains white. Did you read about that?
No, I hadn't seen that.
It seems like it's a little naive and very limited compared to what we're dealing with. So, look, I was fascinated, of course, to read about how you scientists have worked out that the ocean level is rising and the seas are getting warmer, but going right back in time through the... How has the sea level changed through the ice ages? Back to when the CO2 levels, carbon dioxide levels, were higher in the atmosphere. Can you just outline, John Church, the progression of global warming, I suppose, and global freezing from the ice ages through to where we are now?
Okay, if we first look at, perhaps look at the last ice age cycle for the moment.
Which was when?
Well, if we go back to about 130,000 years before present,
yes,
that's the time of the last interglacial, sometimes called the Eemian. At that time, the Earth was slightly warmer than it is today. Sea levels were higher than they are today, probably more than 6 metres higher than current day sea levels. And as I said, the Earth was slightly warmer. Temperatures that we might expect to get to late this century.
So why was it warmer? What were the factors causing it to be warmer 180,000 years ago?
130,000 years
130,000,
ago.
130,000, excuse me.
I think primarily changes in solar radiation compared to today.
Well, how does solar radiation change then? What happens in the sun to cause the Earth to heat up? What is it, solar flares or...
No, it's primarily not so much changes in the solar radiation, but changes in the solar radiation received at the Earth, mm-hmm, associated with changes in the Earth's orbit. So the orbit is the Earth's orbit is tilted as it rotates around the sun,
yeah,
and that tilt varies. The orbit is eccentric, and the eccentricity varies. All these factors combine to change the amount of solar radiation received at the Earth.
What are the factors that alter the eccentricity of
the
Earth's orbit?
These are natural factors just associated with the long-term evolution of the Earth's orbit. They're completely natural. We have absolutely no control over them.
No, I understand we'd have no control. When you say... an interglacial period, yet we're dealing with the ice age 130,000 years ago. What does the interglacial period mean?
So the interglacial, like today is an interglacial period.
Yeah.
Over the last million years, we've had a series of glacial interglacial periods. So 130,000 years ago was an interglacial period where the Earth was warm, mm, sea levels were high, there was less ice on land. And then from about 130,000 years ago up to about 20,000 years ago, the Earth gradually cooled, sea level fell as major ice sheets formed, mm, particularly on North America and Northern Europe. It fell to about more than 120 metres below present-day sea level about 20,000 years ago. And so that was the ice age. And then from the ice age, the ice sheets started to melt and slide into the ocean, and the planet warmed. And from about 20,000 years ago until about 7,000 years ago, sea level rose rapidly at average rates of the order of a meter per century for many millennia, but peak rates somewhat larger than that, perhaps 4 meters per century. And then from about 7,000 years ago, sea level started to stabilize, rose less rapidly for a few thousand years, and then over the last couple of thousand years, rates of sea level rise up until about 1800 have been very small.
Well, now human beings have been around for what, 100,000 years or so?
About 200,000 years.
How did they cope with that ice age when much of Europe and North America was covered with ice sheets, John Church?
Well, that's going outside my area of expertise, but clearly they would have been severely impacted by changes in temperature and ice cover. But changes in sea level also assisted their migration in various parts of the world. Lower sea levels allowed land bridges to form, so it's thought that the migration from Eastern Asia to North America occurred towards the end of the last ice age via a land route that opened up and allowed human migration across that passage.
And what about the land bridge between South Asia, India and Australia? Isn't that probably where the now Aborigines migrated from India to Australia 40,000 years ago about?
So there would have, lower sea levels would have assisted that migration as well. I think there would have still been some water that they would have had to cross, but it would have been much narrower than it is today.
Isn't that fascinating? So climate change right through the ages has had a huge impact upon human populations and, of course, animals as well. Then, okay, so from the last ice age 30,000 years ago, what caused then the Earth to heat up again? Was it CO2 collection, carbon dioxide collection? Was it the Earth's orbit around the sun? What was it, John Church?
So over the last million years, these ice age cycles have been paced by the solar radiation received from the Earth associated with the Earth's orbit. But that solar forcing on its own is not strong enough to explain the observed changes in climate.
That's so happening been, now?
Well, just think of the last million years for a start.
Okay.
Then to reinforce those changes, which were initiated by the Earth's orbit, there's also changes in greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, principally carbon dioxide and methane and other greenhouse gases. And these reinforced the warming that came from changes in the solar radiation received from the Earth and led to the ice age cycles.
Well then, what I don't understand is there are no humans pumping CO2 into the atmosphere or other greenhouse gases at that time. So what caused the carbon dioxide concentrations to increase those many thousand years ago, John Church?
So this is again, is getting outside my area, and my understanding, this is not fully understood, but it's thought to be associated with changes in temperature, changes in ice cover, changes in ocean circulation, changes in vegetation of the Earth. So as the Earth warmed, then the oceans can't carry as much carbon dioxide, and some of this was released into the atmosphere, increasing the atmospheric greenhouse gases.
So let's come up to the present time and last century. At the beginning of the last century, the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere was 280 parts per million, right?
Right.
Now, can you tell us what has happened since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution when anthropogenic or man-made changes have occurred to the atmosphere?
Yeah. So since the start of the Industrial Revolution, CO2 concentrations in the atmosphere have increased. They're now about 390 parts per million compared to 280 parts per million during the most of the Holocene period. And that compares with the concentrations of 180 parts per million during the Ice Age.
What is the Holocene period? I don't know that.
Oh, the Holocene, over the last several thousand years.
Okay.
Basically the period since the end of the last glacial.
Last Ice Age, yeah, okay.
And so they were about 280, the burning of fossil fuels, the clearing of forests have all added to the atmospheric concentration. It's now about 390 parts per million and increasing at about 2 parts per million per year, with the largest contribution to that coming from the burning of fossil fuels, but clearing of forests also contributes.
And also ploughing of the soil, doesn't it?
There's many factors associated with the air-sea exchange of carbon dioxide. The terrestrial region is particularly important. It's one of the less well understood, so there's exchanges both with the trees and the forests, etc., but as you say, also with the soil. And of course, there's also an exchange with the ocean. The annual exchange between the ocean and the atmosphere, and also the atmosphere and the land, is very large. The ocean, it's about 90 gigatons per year. But that's a seasonal exchange.
That means absorption of the gas carbon dioxide into the oceans. Is that correct?
Yes. So the oceans take up that amount of carbon dioxide and then release it again later on a seasonal cycle.
They release it during the winter.
Well, it depends where you are.
And
there's obviously different periods,
And what about the other very scary global warming gas, I believe, John Church, is methane, which is now starting to be released in large quantities from the warming oceans and also from the peat and permafrost that is now melting, particularly in the Northern Hemisphere. Is that correct?
Methane is an important greenhouse gas as well. It is being released both by our burning of fossil fuels, by the leakage from those pipelines, etc. There are large amounts of peat and carbon, large amounts of methane and carbon locked up in peat, frozen, particularly in northern Europe, northern Asia, which could potentially be released, and there are some examples of that release occurring.
Yeah, well, I think that they're very worried that as the Arctic ice melts and the permafrost melts in the Northern Hemisphere particularly, there are going to be huge increases of methane. And methane is 20 times more potent as a global warmer than carbon dioxide, correct?
Methane is more potent. I thought the factor was smaller than the factor of 20, but it certainly is a more potent greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. But it also has a somewhat shorter lifetime.
Yeah, I think it's about 20 years, yes. I'm interviewing John Church, who actually is the world's leading expert in sea level rises, and I serendipitously discovered him when I went to a conference in Hobart, and I didn't even know that John Church was down there, let alone is the leading expert in the world on sea level rise. So it's a great privilege to have you on the show, John Church. So now the next question is, why is sea level changing right now, and what is causing the change or rise increase in sea level?
Okay, so sea level, as we discussed, stabilized over the last couple of thousand years.
Mm-hmm.
So the rate of rise was very small. There may have been some small ongoing melting, particularly or contribution to sea level from the Antarctic ice sheet, but only a couple of tenths of a millimetre per year at most. From roughly the 19th century through to the 20th century, and during the 20th century, the rate of rise has increased.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly, you can see a change in the rate of rise from the 19th to the 20th century. The average rate of rise during the 20th century was about 1.7 millimetres per year, and that compares to with the 0.1, 0.2 millimetres per year over previous millennia. And then since 1993, when we've had satellite observations to measure global sea levels rather than just coastal sea levels, which we have previously measured, the rate of rise has increased again. It's over 3 millimetres per year since 1993. And that's confirmed both from the satellite measurements and from our coastal sea level measurements.
Now, let's talk about the Arctic ice melt, but particularly the Greenland ice sheet. Can you explain to the listeners, John Church, how large, what is the measurement of the Greenland ice sheet?
Can I first... the Greenland ice sheet is critically important, and I think we should come back to it. But I think first it's probably worthwhile addressing, well, what has happened, why has sea level risen during the, 20th century?
Yep.
And the reason for that is really three major contributions. Firstly, as the oceans warm, they expand.
As water expands when it is heated.
Exactly the same phenomena as with a thermometer. You heat the liquid in a thermometer, the level in the thermometer rises.
Right.
So the oceans are the Earth's thermometer in some way.
Interesting, yes.
And so the oceans have absorbed huge amounts of heat. As a result, they've expanded and sea level has risen. And that's one of the two largest contributions to sea level rise, particularly during the last 50 years where we have a better understanding, but probably throughout the 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, there are glaciers and ice caps all around the world. These are small glaciers, places like Patagonia, Alaska, Himalayas, etc. They contain variable estimates of how much sea level equivalent they contain, but probably about 60 centimetres of sea level equivalent if they all melted. They have been melting during the 20th century. There's widespread observations of melting glaciers and ice caps. There's a very large number of these glaciers and ice caps, so actually estimating the contribution to sea level is difficult, but they're probably, along with ocean thermal expansion, the two most important contributions to sea level rise. And then there's the ice sheets. So there's two or major ice sheets. There's the Antarctic ice sheet to the south of Australia, and then there's the Greenland ice sheet. The Greenland ice sheet contains enough water to raise sea level by about 7 metres if it were to completely melt. At the moment, the Greenland ice sheet, there's a balance between snowfall occurring on Greenland, which compacts to form ice, and gradually that ice flows off into the ocean, discharging as glaciers through glaciers as icebergs into the ocean. In addition to that ice discharge, the surface of Greenland also melts, particularly during summer, of course. And so at the moment, the balance for the snowfall on Antarctica is approximately 50% from iceberg discharge and 50% from surface melting. Now, since we have satellite observations of Greenland, the area of melt on the Greenland ice sheet has been increasing. The volume of melt entering into the ocean has been increasing. And recently, we've also learned that the flow of ice into the ocean has also been increasing.
As icebergs.
As icebergs. And so all of these things are contributing to sea level.
What's the difference between an ice cap and an ice sheet, John Church?
So I made a distinguish between glacier and ice caps. So glaciers are ice in river valleys which are flowing down like a river.
Mm-hmm.
An ice cap is a layer of ice over the top of a mountain.
Oh, I see.
But you can usually see the topography that underlies that ice.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas an ice sheet is, like in Greenland and Antarctica, is so thick that you can't see the topography any longer.
So how thick is the ice sheet in Greenland?
They're several kilometres.
About 2 kilometres thick.
I think it's actually slightly more than
yeah,
that.
I think it is. And then I was fascinated by the way that the ice sheet in Greenland is melting. First of all, as you said, there's surface melt, and then sort of rivers and creeks are made as the water cuts through various places in the Greenland ice sheet to reach the solid rock below. And as the Greenland ice sheet rests on rock and as water collects underneath the ice sheet, so the Greenland ice sheet starts sliding with the sort of lubrication of the water towards the ocean. And when that happens, more and more icebergs break off. Is that an accurate description, John Church?
Yes, to some extent. It's certainly true there's lots of ice melting on Greenland, and you can see this water flowing off as rivers and, as you say, flowing down, forming holes in the ice sheet, making its way down to the base of the ice sheet, and then flowing off into the ocean. And there are examples where we can actually see a lake that has formed on the surface of the Greenland ice sheet, that's suddenly broken through and drained very rapidly down to the base or down through the ice sheet at least. Whether it made its way right to the base is probably unclear. And seen the sort of rapid response of the Greenland ice sheet to that in terms of a increased sliding for a relatively short period of time, though. So it's thought that this process is important, but it's only contributes a relatively minor amount to the increased flow of the ice sheets. But it is a fascinating process. How does this happen? But what is perhaps more concern is the warm ocean water penetrating below the ice shelves. So these are where the ice from the ice sheet meets the ocean and starts to flow out over the ocean. Warm water can penetrate below the ice shelves, so warm water from the ocean, and melt the ice sheet shelves at their base. And particularly, they can melt the ice shelves at the grounding line, so that's the point where the ice just starts to float into the ocean. And when they melt the ice shelves, they can release the buttressing that stops some of the ice flowing, and the ice can flow more rapidly into the ocean. This is a little bit like having a bottle lying on its side and taking out the cork, which allows the water to flow more rapidly. In this case, if you destabilize the ice shelves, you allow the ice sheets or the outlet glaciers from those ice sheets to flow more rapidly. And that's thought to be the important process. There are observations of this occurring. There's starting to be models, at least in regions, of this process, which seem to explain the observations better than the process of surface melt and the surface melt making its way to the base of the glacier. But we don't have complete models that allow us to do proper projections of this process for both Greenland and the Antarctic ice sheet.
So let's talk about the West Antarctic ice sheet, which obviously is at the South Pole. It's pretty big, isn't it? And what exactly is happening there? Can you describe that, John Church?
So the Antarctic ice sheet is much bigger than the Greenland ice sheet, and it's really divided into two. The West Antarctic ice sheet, which contains, it's about 3 to 5 metres of sea level equivalent that could contribute to sea level rise relatively rapidly. The East Antarctic ice sheet is much bigger and most of it more stable. The same processes that are occurring in some regions of the Greenland ice sheet are also occurring in the West Antarctic ice sheet. The critical point to recognize is that for much of the West Antarctic ice sheet, it is grounded below sea level. That is, the ice is so thick that it's resting on land, which is below current day sea level.
Oh, wow.
Now, the process that I described of warm water penetrating under the ice sheet is occurring in the West Antarctic ice sheet, and particularly in the region of the Thwaites and the Pine Island Glacier, we're seeing a thinning of these regions, a loss of mass from these regions, and a more rapid flow of glaciers into the ocean. One of the critical issues is that for parts of this ice sheet at least, the base of the ice sheet or the land slopes downwards as you go away from the ocean rather than sloping up as you go away from the ocean. So when in these conditions, when warm water penetrates underneath, the situation and starts melting the ice sheet at its base, at the grounding line, then these situations can be unstable. And so either the ice sheet progresses until it meets a new rise, which stabilizes it, or this melting process continues until some other mechanism to stop it is reached.
I don't quite understand the significance of the fact that the ground underneath the West Antarctic ice sheet slopes down, not up, below sea level. So what is the dynamic of the warmer sea melting the ice at ground level where the ice and the rock merge? But what happens then further inland as the ground recedes below sea level?
So what happens in these ice shelves is that warm ocean water that's denser because it has more salt in it, particularly if there's sea ice formed and adds... So when sea ice forms, it rejects the salt.
It's fresh water.
The sea ice is fresh,
yeah.
But the ocean water is dense, so the warm water can be quite dense.
Yeah.
Can penetrate underneath the ice shell,
melts
part of the ice shelf, and so it becomes fresher and lighter, and then flows out underneath the base of the ice shelf, and more ocean water penetrates underneath the ice shelf.
And so flowing downwards as you get further inland onto the...
Yes, so it can continue to flow downwards.
Yeah.
And this process is an unstable situation where the warm ocean water can continue to flow in, continue to melt the ice sheet at its base, freeing it from the topography and allowing it to slide more rapidly.
So then if you add up 5 meters sea rise from the melt of the West Antarctic ice sheet and 7 meters from the Greenland ice sheet, you have 12 meter sea level rise, approximately.
That's a potential scenario on the longer term. For the 21st century, we're not talking about that amount of rise. During the 21st century, there'll be significant contributions from continued warming of the ocean, continued melting of glaciers and ice caps around the world.
Mm.
There'll be continued changes in the surface mass balance. So the amount of snowfall, the amount of melting on the Greenland ice sheet. And when we model all of those processes, then the projections from the last IPCC report were an 18 to 59 centimetres sea level rise by 2100. What this did not include was the dynamic response we've just been talking about.
Mm.
And which they didn't know how to make an estimate for this additional component. But it's important to recognize that this is essentially a one-sided uncertainty. It can increase the amount of sea level rise and the rate of sea level rise, but it can't substantially decrease it. But what they did was a simple scaling argument which said perhaps an extra 10 or 20 centimeters by 2100. But we can't really be sure. So that would make a range of 18 to 79 centimetres by 2095, actually. So about 18 to 80 centimetres by 2100. But still, we don't really understand these ice sheets very well. So actually, it could be more.
What's the worst-case scenario, John Church?
Well, if you look at the paleo evidence, so this is evidence particularly from the last interglacial.
Uh-huh.
So these are conditions somewhat similar to what we might expect.
How many years ago?
So 130,000 years
right.
ago. Right. So you're looking back through the Earth's history to see, has this happened before and how quickly could things change? And what that tells us that temperatures... 130,000 years ago, in the last interglacial, were about similar to what we might expect at the end of this century. Sea levels were higher, and coming into those high sea levels, rates of sea level rise were very likely greater than 6 meters per millennia.
Goodness.
So that's 6 meters in 1,000 years. So that's about 60 centimeters in a century. If it was just continued at the average rate, and most likely or very likely less than about 9 meters per millennium. So that's 90 centimeters in a century. So that's consistent with the upper end of the IPCC. Projections, perhaps a little bit higher than that. Recently, there's been a number of simple models developed which try to estimate sea level by scaling it essentially to global average temperatures. People did this because they recognized that this was a critically important issue, but we didn't know how to adequately model the ice sheets as yet. So could we find a simple way of doing it?
Mm.
And these models have come up with somewhat larger numbers than over a meter, well over a metre per century. I personally am very cautious about such models. They're based on very simple ideas and they're tuned to conditions in the 20th century, which are probably not what will be the major contributors in the 21st century. So certainly rates of a metre per century by 2100 are possible, and perhaps larger rates. But as I said, the projections from the last IPCC report are probably 18 to about 80 centimetres and perhaps more. But it's also important to recognise that sea level rise will not stop in 2100. Mm. The ocean has got very long timescales, 1,000 years plus, so sea level rise will continue from ocean thermal expansion for centuries, probably millennia, even after greenhouse gases concentrations are stabilised. The ice sheets will continue to respond for millennia also. You talked about what could happen. One of the important scenarios to consider is the surface melting of the Greenland ice sheet. There's a temperature at which surface melting alone exceeds snowfall in Antarctica. So this leads to an ongoing decay of the Greenland ice sheet, no matter what happens to the outlet glacier flow. This threshold is thought to be somewhere between about 2 degrees and 4 degrees Celsius, above pre-industrial temperatures. We already had about 0.7 degrees, so if you think about the lower limit, we're 0.7 of the way towards 2.2 degrees. We're probably committed to at least another 0.6 or more degrees Celsius, even if we stabilise concentrations at today's level, probably somewhat more, in fact. So we're well on the way to approaching this threshold and crossing this threshold late this century without very significant and urgent mitigation of greenhouse gases.
Which doesn't seem to be occurring. I'm interviewing John Church from Hobart in Tasmania, the most southern state of Australia, who is in fact the world's leading expert on sea level rise during the global warming period. So let's talk about then, John, storms and how these various climatic catastrophes, so to speak, are aggravated or can aggravate sea level rise, and also the number of people are currently living at sea level or just above and how they would be affected.
Okay, so there's a few things we should recognise here. Firstly, our society is essentially a coastal society. Many people live near the coast around the world. Many of our major cities are based right at the coast. And this coastal society has developed over the last 1,000 years plus during a period of very stable sea levels. And in fact, in some regions, sea level relative to the land has been falling because the land has been rising. And this is associated with changes in the ice sheets and changes in the surface load of the Earth, so the shape of the Earth changes slightly.
Mm-hmm.
So this has allowed us as a society to develop right up to the coastline and enjoy the oceans, as many of us do.
Particularly in Australia.
Particularly in Australia, that's true, but many other areas of the world as well.
Yeah.
We've now changed, or sea level, the rate of sea level rise has now changed over the last century and a half or two centuries. The rate of rise has increased. Many areas where sea level might have been falling very slightly, it's now falling, it's now rising and rising more rapidly. Places like the east coast of America, where sea level was already falling as a result of sinking, falling land in that region. The rate of rise has now increased. Our coastal society is impacted by extreme events. So these are storms, particularly associated with tropical cyclones or hurricanes. A good example is, of course, Hurricane Katrina and its impact on New Orleans. Changes in sea level changes the frequency in which a coastal flooding event of a given magnitude occurs. So you can think of a particular threshold which is important because it has some impact on coastal coastal cities or coastal developments. Virtually all around the world, there are many locations where the frequency of exceeding these thresholds have increased markedly during the 20th century. If you look at the east coast and west coast of Australia, for example, Sydney and Fremantle, which are the two longest sea level records that we have in Australia, if you compare the first half of the 20th century to the last half of the 20th century, for coastal flooding events that occur about once a decade, then they're now occurring three times more frequently during the last half of the 20th century than the first half of the 20th century. So already during the 20th century, we've seen this factor of three increase in these extreme coastal flooding events.
What about areas like Bangladesh, where, you know, millions, 200 million people or more live at sea level on a delta of a river?
Yeah.
What's going to happen there? What are the predictions there, John Church?
Let me just finish off one more comment about storms. So what I'm not saying here is that the frequency of storms will increase.
Right.
That's a separate issue.
Yeah.
Just sea level alone
causes
coastal flooding events to increase in frequency. And that's a very robust finding. And it's a finding you can project into the future. So for places like Sydney, by 2100, the current 1-in-100-year coastal flooding event is likely to be happening several times per year. So from a 1-in-100-year event to several times per year.
So what causes the coastal flooding? I you know, I understand sea level rise, but what causes these events that could occur?
They're associated with storms.
Yeah.
Tides.
Yeah.
So sea level is varying on all timescales.
Yeah, so as the sea level rises, an ordinary storm that wouldn't have caused coastal flooding previously will now cause coastal flooding.
Exactly.
Yeah, I get it. So ordinary storms become much more dangerous now and in the future than they were in the past because of sea level rise.
Exactly.
Yeah, okay, got it.
You asked about countries like Bangladesh.
Yeah.
So many of the most densely populated areas around the world are deltaic regions like Bangladesh. So sea level rising is impacting these regions. But in addition, many of these deltaic regions are sinking. So the sediments themselves compact. And if you extract water from the sediments, they compact more rapidly. And this is happening in many regions, Bangladesh included. Bangkok is another place. So minimizing withdrawal of water slows that rate of compaction. And this falling of the land can be quite significant, and in at least local regions can be larger than the rate of sea level rise, but it's additional to the rate of sea level rise.
So in places like Bangladesh and I suppose Bangkok and many other places, people draw their fresh water from wells, and that causes further impacting, as you've just described. But also, as the sea level rises, those wells can then become polluted and become salty instead of fresh water as the sea impacts upon the fresh water beneath the soil. Is that correct?
Yes, it's, again, you're getting a little bit out of my expertise, but I expect that to be the situation.
Yeah, yeah, I read that in Sir Nicholas Stern's report.
The when you look around the world and say, well, what is at risk in this coastal zone around the world? And perhaps let's just consider the 1 metre above current day sea levels or current high tide sea levels around the world. So this is the area that's potentially at risk from sea level rise mm-hmm. during the 20th century. About 140 million people live in this forest, 1 meter above sea level around the world.
Yeah.
There's about $1 trillion of GDP generated in this first 1 meter of sea level.
Yeah.
So there is a lot at risk here. There are a number of responses that we can have to this. We can, of course, retreat from parts of the coastline and abandon parts of the coastline. This is already occurring in parts of the world, parts mm-hmm. of the UK. They have a plan of planned retreat because it's too expensive to protect all areas of the coastline. Mm. We can accommodate sea level rise by building coastal infrastructure higher, for example, having sports fields in low-lying areas where it's not so critical if they're occasionally or repeatedly flooded. Or in some cases, we can protect valuable coastlines. And again, we will do that, and we are already doing that. We have the Thames Barrage protecting about £100 billion of assets in the City of London from storm surges. The Thames Barrage has been closed more frequently in recent years. A couple of years ago, a storm surge came within centimetres of overtopping the Thames Barrage.
Oh, goodness.
And they're actively planning for what extensions they need to the Thames Barrage to increase the protection level for the City of London. Of course, Rotterdam also has a similar storm surge protection barrier. And, of course, much of the Netherlands, a significant part of the Netherlands, is below sea level.
I know that, about one-third, isn't it?
I think I don't know the exact number, yeah, I'm sorry, but a significant portion and a significant population and GDP of Netherlands below sea level.
Well, now, John Church, we're running out of time. We've got 5 more minutes, but there is now a potent, as they would say, robust debate going on in Australia about immigration here and refugees. But I say to the government, you ain't seen nothing yet, because it's been predicted for a long time, but it's now about to occur. Millions of ecological refugees will be fleeing because of just sea level rise, let alone anything else. And they'll be coming, I'm sure, to the shores of Australia, let alone elsewhere in boats or however they can get here, because Australia's a huge empty continent virtually. I find this fascinating that, it, although it's self-evident to me and many others like you and the climate change workers, that it's not being addressed at all by the politicians. Can you briefly just sort of give us your thoughts on that, John Church?
Personally, I feel environmental refugees will be a major issue during the 21st century.
Yeah.
The difficulty is that sea level rise, like much of other climate change, actually, will be felt firstly through extreme events, through extreme coastal flooding events. Mm. And New Orleans is a good example, although it wasn't primarily a result of sea level rise. It's a combination of sinking land motion, sea level rise, and extreme events which impact society, and that will continue during the 21st century and have more significant impacts on many more people around the world.
Yeah.
So there will be people fleeing from those situations. They'll occur firstly through acute situations, So there was the cyclone Nargis, which hit Myanmar a couple of years ago. You know, over 100,000 people died in that storm surge. That's the type of thing that will continue through the 21st century.
Yeah.
So that will impact environmental refugees. Extreme events will occur. Disasters will occur. It's more not whether they will occur, but when and where they will occur, and how we as a society are going to respond to these events and try and anticipate these events.
Yes, well, we as scientists, or you particularly, and your colleagues need to be, I think, warning governments about, you know, these potential catastrophes and the refugees. And as I said earlier, I think governments, particularly ours in Australia, but I'm sure many, you know, in the US and the like, are fairly unaware in a way of what this actually means to societies such as ours and elsewhere in the world.
I think one of the big issues that we haven't fully appreciated is the urgency of the situation.
Yes.
The approaching threshold for melting of the Greenland ice sheet and what that would mean in committing the world to meters of sea level rise. This is rapidly approaching. If we don't take urgent and very significant action, then we will cross that threshold.
Well, John Church, it's been an absolute pleasure to interview you and a privilege, I would say. And I think that this particular interview from the radio show, If You Love This Planet, should in fact be played to every single member of parliament in Australia and England and Europe, and also to every member of Congress in the US, so that they can understand the urgency of the situation. And it's clear that scientists need to partner with politicians now in order to do the necessary actions to prevent ongoing global warming and ongoing sea level rise. So I thank you very much, John Church, for this really fascinating and edifying interview.
Thank you, Helen.
Yes, thank you. This week on If You Love This Planet, you've been listening to John Church, an Australian who's an oceanographer with the Centre for Australian Weather and Climate Research, with expertise in the role of the ocean in climate, particularly anthropogenic or man-made climate change. In truth, John Church is the world's leading expert on sea level rise, and it was a great privilege to have him here for the show If You Love This Planet. You can go to our website to access this or other programs at ifyoulovethisplanet.org. You can also go to another website now called nuclearfreeplanet.org to learn more about nuclear and climate change issues. And this was set up specifically to get to the younger generations through Facebook and Twitter and the like. Thanks for joining us this week. We'll be on with someone else who's absolutely fascinating next week. Thanks for listening, and goodbye for now.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.